the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the face of medicine is about to change in ways that you can't expect. And it's not just technological innovation. Joining me on the program is James Maskell. He's author of the new book, The Evolution of Medicine. Join the movement to solve chronic disease and fall back in love with medicine. James, in your book, you talk about today in the U.S., healthcare consumes almost 19% of GDP. You look at the field of medicine through the lens of economics. Explain that to our listeners, if you would.
My degree was in health economics in the UK, and it was kind of a joke in health economics. When you look at all the different countries in the world, you have different ways that they deal with their medical costs. So in Japan, they came up with a plan that they would say, okay, 6% of all GDP is going to go to medicine, and you, the medical system, have to work out how to use that money to keep the population healthy. Now, in America, you have a different situation where you, in the last 40 years, you have the three biggest players in medicine, pharmaceuticals, hospitals, and insurance companies, who all have the incentive to increase costs. Most people think insurance companies have the incentive to reduce costs, but they actually don't. It's more like a cost-plus type of scenario. And so, in that case, you've seen this massive increase in costs over the last three or four decades to a point where now it's $3.4 trillion. It's the biggest industry in the world. And that includes $10,000 per person for every person in the country. And yes, it's up to 18.9% of GDP this year and rising. And so you can see that from an economic point of view, these aren't really like goods and services in the same way that you're like producing a car or something else that people buy. And so that's what sort of set me on the path to want to make a change in this area, because ultimately, it's going to destroy the economy. You know, if it goes up to 30%, it's going to make all goods and services that Americans produce uncompetitive with other countries. And the production of medicine is not really the production of goods and services. It's really the cost of keeping the population healthy. And so it's not really what I think that we should be spending our money on. And I think there's solutions in front of us. And that's part of the goal of the book, is to enlighten the population, particularly physicians, as to some of these solutions.
We've seen a great leap in medicine in the second half of this century, where medicine led to, however, an entrenchment of hierarchy and patriarchy in medicine, and also an increase in what we've seen in non-medical administrators. I have two doctors. I have one who's a naturopath practitioner. He doesn't accept Medicare. He doesn't accept insurance. And one of the reasons he said he did that, he can keep his costs down and spend more of his money on hiring nurses instead of people that push paper. So what happened to medicine?
Yeah, look, it's the same thing that I was talking about before, where like the incentive structures, you know, perverse incentive structures just pushed incentives in the wrong direction and made medicine way more costly. So that's the way that it's been playing out. And you see, you know, you have extremely complex health insurance billing and operation, which means that you have to have 2.5 to 3 operations people for each clinical person. And that's led to a point where, you know, the cost has just increased. If there's an amazing graph that you can see where it shows the number of clinical personnel over the last three decades has increased, you know, very slowly, but the number of administrators in healthcare, all with the goal, ironically, of keeping down costs. All of these administrators have come into hospital systems and insurance systems, and, you know, all of their salaries plus all of the other work that goes into it, you know, someone has to pay those costs, and ultimately it ends up falling on the patient one way or another, or the payer. And that is typically either business or the patient themselves, because the third party payer, like the insurance company, obviously the patient is ultimately the payer for that. And if you're looking at Medicare and Medicaid, ultimately the payer is the taxpayer.
You know, one of the things I was really surprised to read in your book, that the practice of medicine today has led to a lot of dissatisfaction within the industry itself, with even talk about suicides of doctors leaving medical school with post-traumatic stress disorder. What's causing this?
You know, there's a lot of theories on that. I think it does look a lot like post-traumatic stress disorder. There's a doctor called Pamela Weibel who's a friend of mine, who's really been on the charge with this. She did a very provocative TED-Med talk last year that was, you know, really powerful. If you add it up, if you multiply the number of doctors that committed suicide last year by their patient population, that adds up to about 1 million people. Over 400 doctors multiplied by 2,500 patients per doctor. So it's pretty serious. And, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons for it. I think medical school is a very, you know, it's a stressful situation. You're working long hours. The food isn't really very good. The lighting is not very good. You know, the sleep isn't very good. So you're not really creating a lot of health in our population. But then I think also through this industrialization of medicine, you know, if you go back 50 years, you see that most doctors had quite an intimate relationship with patients. They were able to, you know, really help people in the way that they helped. You know, there were these new drugs that were coming around all the time that could help with different situations. You had doctors that had relationships with their patients that really mattered to them. And in this sort of industrial era of medicine where you have 7-minute office visits and you never have quite enough time to help people in the way that they could be helped, you only have enough time to enter the data into the system and prescribe a drug. I think everyone has, you know, become a little disenfranchised with that, and it's not a very satisfying profession anymore. So you can look at the physician suicides as an example of that, but just the general dissatisfaction. There are many surveys that have come out in the last little while that shows the majority of doctors in the medical system, for the first time in history, one, would not recommend that their children go into medicine, which, you know, in some cases is breaking multi-generational eras of family physicians where you have, you know, the son and daughters of physicians becoming physicians. That's breaking for the first time now. And just a big dissatisfaction where doctors are looking for a way out to do something that's more, you know, more life-affirming and makes them happier because they're not getting it through the practice of medicine.
Now, in your book, you talk about a new model for medicine that's going to help solve chronic disease and also get doctors more engaged in falling in love with, you know, practicing medicine. Describe for our listeners what this new model looks like.
Well, so yeah, my book and my organization is called The Evolution of Medicine. And if you understand evolution to be medicine adapting to its environment, there's a new environment in medicine. You know, the old environment and the massive improvements that we saw in medicine in the 20th century were really about us getting a grip on acute disease. So infections, the kind of things that would kill people prematurely in the 19th and 20th centuries through sanitation and through antibiotics, we were able to really improve the average lifespan considerably. But in the last part of the 20th century, and now definitely in the 21st century, we're seeing the massive rise in non-communicable disease. So a lot of these diseases are diseases associated with lifestyle. So type 2 diabetes, heart disease, many of the autoimmune diseases, and cancer as well, have strong lifestyle components. And so we're in a new era in medicine, we're in a new environment for medicine, where there's a different type of disease that's out there, and doctors have been trained in the old paradigm. And so, you know, what I've documented in my book essentially is how there's a different strategy that's needed for combating these non-communicable diseases, because ultimately these are being brought on to the patient by their lifestyle choices. And the early adopters of doctors that have started to learn these strategies not only are helping their patients reverse and prevent these chronic diseases by inspiring them to behavior change and to help them lead more healthy lifestyles, but the early indications are that this is extremely satisfying for doctors, that this is getting back in touch with the real reasons that they went to medical school. And so what I see is that there's an opportunity by training doctors in these new methods and setting up models where this kind of care is affordable and available to everyone in society, you can solve these two massive problems, chronic disease and physician dissatisfaction, in one elegant solution.
So, you know, if you look at the typical practice of medicine today involves, you know, prescribing prescription drugs, typically surgeries. Some of these treatments can cure disease, but they aren't designed really to create better health. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, look, I think it's obvious to everyone there's a difference between disease treatment and health creation. You know, here's the question you should ask. If you prescribe a regimen of drugs to someone, let's just say you took that same regimen of drugs and prescribed it to someone who was completely healthy. right? Someone who's all their numbers are in the right range and they're healthy. If you gave them that combination of drugs over a period of, say, the next 4 or 5 years, would they get healthier or would they get sicker? And for most people, the truth is that they would get sicker because most drugs are stopping some sort of process in the body. They are cutting off the ability of communication. They're cutting off pathways, receptor sites, all those kind of areas. That's what they're doing. They're dealing with turning off the symptoms that are associated with those drugs. That's what they're created for. And what we see is that in the healthiest places in the world, there are these areas called blue zones, which have been documented, where we have areas in the world where people live to 100 consistently without these levels of chronic disease. And in these areas, they don't have a lot of medicine, but they make very good use of the fundamentals of health creation. And how do you really create health in people? You know, they eat well, they sleep well, they exercise regularly, they have good sense of community and relationships around them. Those are the fundamentals of health creation, and those are really not what's being delivered in the medical system. And so innovative ways to deliver that kind of care into the system is really necessary. And, you know, what we're sort of marshalling in our community here is a way for practitioners and doctors to learn about what are the fundamentals of health creation, typically something that they're not taught in medical school at all, because that's not the role that they needed in the last year of medicine. We needed doctors who could deal with acute disease, and medical training is still based on that era. But what we're starting to see is that more and more doctors are hungry to learn about how to reverse lifestyle diseases, and therefore the training is available now. The first few pioneering doctors have learned strategies to be able to empower patients on these fundamentals of health creation. And when you see these kind of ideas being brought into the medical system, you see massive disproportional cost savings in the medical system. And you see patients, you know, reversing diseases that are previously thought to be only manageable. Look at type 2 diabetes. You can't reverse type 2 diabetes with any combination of drugs. You can only manage it. But you can reverse type 2 diabetes fairly obviously and quickly and systematically with dramatic changes in lifestyle and with the right support and other therapies to go alongside with it. And so we've seen this example happening, you know, dozen by dozen and hundred by hundred. And my goal with my organization, the book and everything, is to alert doctors to these opportunities to be able to retool the medical system to be able to provide these kind of solutions at scale to every American.
Let's talk about, in your book, you're saying there's this grand convergence in medicine. What defines it? What is the outcome? For example, you mentioned the genomic revolution that's taking place. So how will all of this in technology impact the delivery of treatment and care?
Yeah, the grand convergence that I referred to is a number of factors all coming together at exactly the same time to push forward this movement. So, you know, on one hand, you have, we've already mentioned, the huge escalating cost of treating chronic disease that are not only in America, but in every industrialized country. You know, 25 years ago, there was hardly any type 2 diabetes in China. Now, 25% of the world's type 2 diabetics are in China. My father lives in South Africa. You would think that the number one diagnoses in Africa are going to be things like typhoid and TB, but it's not. It's type 2 diabetes. So you've got the cost of these chronic diseases is a big part of the convergence. Then on the other hand, you have like the wearable health era where now, you know, lots of people in America and all around the world are starting to track their steps and their health, and they have an Apple Watch and they're tracking their health more clearly and looking for ways to improve the numbers on their tracker. You have the genomic revolution where the same test that you're doing now for $100, you know, 10 years ago would have cost $10 million. You know, Moore's Law has been where the reduction in cost of technology now in genomics, everyone can have access to their genomic information. And so all of these things really coming together at the same time to push us forward into a new era of medicine. And the kind of medicine that we're talking about here, you know, if you talk to, you know, Obama last year, put forward this idea of precision medicine, but there's really these four P's that keep coming up as the future of medicine. It's P4 medicine, and this idea was coined by this guy called Dr. Leroy Hood from the Institute of Systems Biology, and it's predictive, preventive, personalized, and participatory. So it should predict disease, it should prevent disease before it shows up, the treatment should be personalized to that person rather than, you know, the old thinking was what's the best treatment for the average person, whereas now it's like what's the best treatment for this person in front of us. And then the fourth P is the most important, and that's participatory. So there's been a fundamental shift in who the most important person is in the medical relationship. Up until now, and in acute disease, if you get hit by a truck, obviously the most important person is the physician, because you don't really want to participate in your care if you're in the emergency room. But if you have type 2 diabetes, the most important person in the medical relationship is the patient, because only they can make the shifts that are required to reverse that. So with this P4 medicine, that's, you know, the grand convergence of all of these areas is leading to pushing forward this idea of P4 medicine. And my work is to make that available to physicians and to facilitate practice systems where we can deliver P4 medicine to the general public and help medicine adapt to its new environment.
But doctor, where are we in terms of handling healthcare? We talked about how it's changing, but where are we moving towards preventing disease, predicting it? In other words, are we going with technology where there's tests that are out there that can detect early signs of a disease and then prevent it? For example, you said type 2 diabetes, you know, you can't cure it as much as you can really take care of it with lifestyle changes.
You can definitely reverse type 2 diabetes. You know, one of the things that's happening, Jim, is that it's becoming more and more obvious that this is possible. One of my really good friends is Dr. Rangan Chatterjee. He's a 6'7" Indian doctor, and he has a TV show on the BBC in the UK where I grew up called Doctor in the House. And last year, it's a TV show. It's kind of like, for the listeners who are in America, it's kind of like Dr. Oz meets Super Nanny. So he's like the Dr. Oz meets Super Nanny character, and he goes to live with people for 30 days in their house, and they have different diseases. And in the first season, he reversed type 2 diabetes, not once but twice, opioid addiction, which is another huge issue in America, eczema. And what he did was by, you know, really seeing people's lifestyle, seeing what they ate, seeing how they exercise, seeing their posture at work. And so here's an example of what's possible, you know, but the obvious thing is that that's not a scalable solution. There's not enough doctors to go and sit with everyone for 30 days. So what we've looked to do is to create more of a scalable system for delivering that kind of care. And so, you know, the medical system is doing a lot of things. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily moving in this way by itself. One of the things that is starting to happen, and what you will see over the next 4 years, is that the way that people get paid is changing. And that's really what's caused a lot of the problems in this medical system currently, is that the way that people are being paid, or doctors are being paid, is to do procedures. Why do specialists make way more money than primary care? It's because the specialists are the one that are doing the procedures. And for every heart stent that a cardiologist puts in someone, they get $1,500. So they want to keep doing as many heart stents as possible to maximize the revenue for their cardiology group. And reversing people's heart disease where they don't need a heart stent, and taking the time to sit with someone and talk to them about how much sugar they're eating, or, you know, those kind of things, doesn't get paid in the same way. So there hasn't been the incentive in the medical system to do anything but very interventionalist medicine like a heart stent. Now, one of the things with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is that over the next 4 years, you will see that there's going to be a shift to outcomes-based payment. And so people are going to be paid for keeping people well over a period of time rather than interventions. So as those incentive structures change, I expect that many more medical systems will be looking for the kind of care that we're advocating. So I would say this is another big part of the convergence, is that as the way that people get paid in medicine changes, will lead to big changes in the what care gets delivered, and there will be more of an incentive towards helping people become in charge of their own health and really participate in their care and reduce the amount of non-communicable disease through healthier lifestyles.
Now, you're an advocate of something you call functional medicine. Explain that to our listeners. What is it? How does it work? And what does it look like?
Yeah, functional medicine was sort of coined in the 70s It's been around for about four decades, a sort of a rogue group of doctors getting together initially in a very small group in the late 70s. And the goal of it was to look at a new paradigm for health creation. What would that look like? Going back to our very first conversation here is like, if we had a paradigm about creating health, what would it look like? And so the purpose of functional medicine is not to treat the disease, but to improve the function, of the organs and systems, improve liver function and gut function and kidney function. What could you do to improve the function of all of these organs? And so functional medicine over the last 25 years has become solidified. There's many organizations now that are teaching how to do functional medicine. And functional medicine, you know, the difference is it's really focused on a systems approach. So in traditional medicine, as we have it now, the body is split up into all these different areas. And that's why you have an endocrinologist and a gastroenterologist and a rheumatologist, and they all focus on different parts of the body. Functional medicine is really focused in on the interaction between the different systems, like how does the digestive system affect the endocrine system? So it's a systems biology approach. It's also focused on what I like to call root cause resolution. So finding out what the root cause of the disease is and dealing with that rather than just dealing with the symptoms. So for instance, with type 2 diabetes, you know, a lot of times with type 2 diabetes, we're dealing with the downstream effects like the diabetic neuropathy, you know, the nerve pain of the result of type 2 diabetes. But if we can go upstream and deal with the insulin sensitivity and, you know, how we're creating the problems further upstream, then we can deal with it there. And then the biggest thing about functional medicine is the focus on the therapeutic relationship between the patient and the provider. So how do we inspire change in the patient? How do we facilitate change in the patient? So functional medicine is a movement that's been happening from its very early beginnings in the 70s. And right now, it's getting extra momentum because the first major health organization has bet on it for the future of chronic disease. And that organization is the Cleveland Clinic. The Cleveland Clinic is known worldwide and understood worldwide to be one of the most innovative organizations of medicine in the world, consistently number one in heart disease, normally number one overall. And they have come to a realization that if they want to be at the most innovative cutting edge of medicine, that they need to be working with functional medicine. And so that's given the whole movement an acceleration, because now this isn't just something done by a few doctors randomly, you know, in their own little corner of medicine, but this is the first part of mainstream medicine saying, oh, this is interesting. We like this. Let's find out more about it. And so I think that's giving the whole movement a lot more momentum and getting patients, providers, and otherwise excited that there might be a new way of dealing with these costly non-communicable diseases.
We've also seen, Doctor, as you point out in your book, The Rise of Alternative Medicine, you had doctors like Dr. Leo Gallen, who wrote the book on leaky gut. But when that first came out, it was sort of frowned upon and looked at as kind of off the wall, where, you know, he was talking about so much of our diseases today are related to the gut.
This is a big part of it, and I appreciate you bringing it up. You know, if you wanted to get laughed out of a medical convention at any point in the last 20 years, the two biggest topics that you could bring up that would, you know, get you laughed out of that doctor meeting were leaky gut, or intestinal permeability is the sort of technical term, and toxins, right? Toxins in our environment causing issues to health. And so, you know, those have been sort of like the words that if you said, you were sort of automatically labeled a quack. And I think we also all know now that the goal of the word quack was to have physicians look down upon things like chiropractic and, you know, these kind of alternative medicine strategies. And so that's been a part of the dogma for the last little while. Now, you know, in the last couple of years, or maybe in the last 5 years, if you put intestinal permeability into PubMed, which is a, you know, search of all the medical literature, you'll see that it appears there a lot. And there is a growing evidence that intestinal permeability is real, and it is leading to a lot of dysfunction, both digestive dysfunction, but also because, you know, all of the organs are connected, it's now clear that maybe rheumatology, joint pain could be caused by intestinal permeability, a whole range of autoimmune diseases can be affected by intestinal permeability. And on the toxin side, you know, it's like, you know, if you said the word toxins at these medical conferences, you'd be laughed out of the room. But in September of 2015, two of the biggest medical organizations, the Endocrine Society and the sort of International OBGYN Society, both came out to say, okay, we've looked at the literature again. Toxins are real. They are affecting health, not only in the person that's affected or exposed to the toxin, but also in the children of those exposed to the toxin. And we now realize that this is real. And so here are two classic examples of science shifting, understand shifting. And so, you know, a lot of physicians who are following the literature are starting to realize, okay, these aren't wacky theories by crazy people in alternative medicine. These are important things for us to understand if we're going to really help our patients and create health. And functional medicine has had, you know, these concepts at the core. And so that's another reason why functional medicine is starting to be taken more seriously, because it's a medical paradigm that already has built into it some of these concepts.
I want to talk about some of the bureaucratic red tape. We all know, and doctors deal with this all the time, whether it's dealing with billing an insurance company, getting something approved by an insurance company, or even Medicare. How does one get past that to deliver good health care?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, obviously, insurance companies have been right at the center of approving what gets done. I just want to remind you from what I said earlier is that insurance companies do not have any incentive at this current moment to reduce costs. They have every incentive to increase costs. You know, they get paid on a percentage of what they bill. So if your health insurance is $100 a month, say if it's 20%, they get $20. If it's $1,000 a month, they get $200. So you can see they have no incentive to cut the costs. And so that's been a big drive. As I said, there is going to be a shift with outcome-based payments. So now, you know, physicians and providers are going to get paid based on actually what the health they create and service and value that they provide into the healthcare system. And so, you know, I think that's going to change. But also, you know, we are starting to see the very beginnings of what this is going to look like. So I predict that in about 3 years' time, you'll see another grand convergence, and it's really the same convergence. But in about 3 years' time, you'll have the majority of health insurance paying via this new value-based care model. At the same time that you'll see things like the Cleveland Clinic and the research that they're doing there, the outcomes research they're doing, showing that they can get better results for less money, better outcomes at lower cost, using functional medicine for the majority of non-communicable diseases.
So when you take a look at this in terms of where we're going, 75% of functional medicine has a cash pay system. Only 20% is insurance. So are you talking about a whole new paradigm here when it comes to how we pay for and deliver medical care?
Well, that paradigm is being thrust upon us, Jim. I mean, you know, you've seen the news recently. Obamacare premiums are going up by 25%. One in five people in this country only has one health insurance company to choose from. Like, this is being forced upon us anyway. And if you have a massive high deductible now, let's say your deductible for your family is $10,000, and you used to be on what was a Cadillac plan, and now you're on a high deductible plan, right? So, you know, now that first $10,000 that you're going to spend, you're going to be paying cash anyway. And so, you know, you can pay cash to the functional medicine doctor, or you can pay cash to your whoever you would go and see, primary care and whatever. The truth is, it's an open and fair competition. Now, the cool thing is that as consumers, which all of us are, we know how to find value in what we use our money for. You know, most people are used to spending cash on different products and services, and they use their cash on different products and services. And, you know, and so they're used to finding value in every other industry. So it's no big deal for us to look for value in the space. So you see more and more patients are paying out of pocket for functional medicine because they realize they're having to pay anyway. Maybe they have a health savings account, or maybe they're just still about to meet their deductible. And so they're paying, you know, for time with a functional medicine doctor because they know that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And they're wanting to keep themselves healthy because they realize the cost of not doing so is much higher than it used to be too, because they're going to have to pay for their first $5,000-$10,000 of their care from their deductible. So in a certain weird and ironic way, things are moving in a direction where more and more people are willing to pay cash for their care because the insurance that they have to pay now due to the new legislation is not providing the kind of care they want. And you're also seeing like the rise of alternative means of dealing with insurance. Today is November the 1st, and this is the beginning of open enrollment. So now you can openly enroll into different health insurance things. Now, one option that most people don't know about, Jim, is a thing called health cost sharing, where there are organizations that were given an opportunity to opt out of the Obamacare mandate where everyone had to have health insurance if you were part of a community. This is what I do for myself and my family. Use an organization called Liberty Direct, where, you know, me and 35,000 of my healthy friends have decided that we're healthy and we decide that we're going to spread the risk of our health through us and our 35,000 friends. So I save my cost of what used to be a premium, but now is like a shared amount that everyone in the group puts in together, is about a third of the cost of what it would be for me to have the crummiest plan on the Affordable Care Act. So there's innovation happening in the space because people are realizing, like, anytime your health insurance goes up 25%, you're going to have a lot of people that are struggling and people are looking for new options. So there is innovation happening. And, you know, if you spend time online and look for alternatives to health insurance, those do exist. Liberty Direct is one of those. But I think we're going to see more and more innovation in that space. People just become fed up with paying for health insurance that they don't really use.
One of the big issues right now is the increase in the premiums for Obamacare on the exchanges. The average, according to Health and Human Services, is 25%. You have issues like Arizona where it could be 116%, but 38 states, James, have increases that are going to be double digits. This is unsustainable.
Totally unsustainable. Yeah, I completely agree. And look, this is the biggest wallet share for most people after you pay your rent. You know, this is a big wallet share as your health insurance. So it is unsustainable. And so people are going to be looking for other alternatives. And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, we're living this in real time. You know, I have my health cost sharing plan, and so I'm insulated from these kind of issues. But for most people who are facing that down, they're going to be looking for other solutions because it's really painful. Double digit increases in monthly expenses, especially in something that's eating up the majority of their wallet share. And it's not something you can opt out of. Otherwise, you have to pay fine. It's a big issue, no matter where you stand on it. So it's saddening in a certain way, but it's also, you know, I think pushing people to look at different options because there's very few people in the country now who can sit back and say, yeah, my health system or the health system is really working for me. And I think it's moments like that where we see, you know, substantial positive change.
Well, listen, doctor, it was great reading your book. And it's kind of nice to know that the profession itself is evolving and moving in an area that I think is going to be more patient-centered and also more disease preventive orientation rather than just dispensing pills and doing operations.
Well, thank you for that. And yeah, look, I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful. I think there is this grand convergence that's happening. You know, America in a certain way was the first to get this big upswing in non-communicable disease because we like invented Coca-Cola and McDonald's and all the things that cause it. And so we're a bit ahead of the curve. And so I'm hopeful that this pressure point in medicine right now, in American medicine, will lead to solutions. And I would just prepare your listeners for the fact that what might be the solution to this might end up looking a little bit more like Uber and a bit less like a hospital being transformed, because I think technology is coming around to create efficiencies in delivery. You know, things like telemedicine, where you can see a doctor via your phone. Everyone has a smartphone now. But I think that, you know, be prepared for the fact that the solution to this problem may not look like what you think it's going to look like. But I really feel that this issue is going to spur a level of innovation that will actually lead to better solutions for everyone. So while it's a short-term pain, I expect this to lead to long-term solutions that are caused by the pain that's being created for providers right now. So I'm very hopeful.
Well, listen, James, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. The name of the book is called The Evolution of Medicine. Join the movement to solve chronic disease. Fall back in love with medicine by James Maskell. James, thank you for joining us on the program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, that concludes my interview with James Maskell. I read about this book in the Wall Street Journal talking about the trends in medicine from alternative care and the way medical services are going to be delivered and practiced in the future. Rather hopeful that this takes place because obviously at almost 19% of GDP and rising, and especially if you take a look at some of these healthcare premiums that could go up with Obamacare, we're getting in a situation that is no longer sustainable. So it's good to see that change is coming. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.